Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I have once again failed to understand the question correctly.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkins from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Ka-chow!
And from Music Video Sins, Barrett Sher.
What happened?
So, yeah, today we are back to remote, just taking some precautions. Not that we, think we have COVID or anything, but both Barrett and I had been around people who reported having COVID, so we decided
crazy time, man.
Being as all Tennessee ICU beds are reportedly full, we're being extra precautionous.
We ain't around, folks. And you shouldn't too. Your shit done. Get your shit did. Get your vaccinated. Get your mask on. Mm-hmm. Take one bite and end it.
I agree with the sentiment, man, but how many people out there have been told the same message over and over again at this point and haven't done it because of conspiracy theories?
You got a good point. If Olivia Rodrigo could not reach these people, they're probably not listening to me.
That's true. That's true.
Listen, I saw yesterday that in 1 week, Metro Nashville Schools already has 1,000 people isolated or quarantining. And that is a school system requiring masks for teachers and students. So we're not fucking around for now. We're going to take it week by week. And all of us are vaccinated, but we're taking extra precautions. And you know what? If it means a 5% dip in audio quality, we hope that you guys will just bear with us. But
yeah,
I don't even think most of you will care all that much.
It won't be a big change, I don't think. I mean, there are subtle things that you hear in the live everybody in the same room podcasts, but sound quality wise, I think we're always pretty up there. I don't have an issue with our audio when we're doing it remote. So
as long as you can hear our lovely voices.
Mm-hmm.
Our luscious lips smacking.
That's right. That's correct. But today is going to be a question and answer session. We have tons of questions that have piled up. We've actually answered more questions than we usually have over the past couple of months. There's been months during this podcast where we didn't answer any of them, and then we had this huge pile. Afterwards, we still have a huge pile today, but we've answered more than we have in the past. We get time in for like one or two every once in a while. So while we have a pile, it's not as big of a pile as it normally is when we get to these type of things. So, I guess Barrett, go ahead and tee us off on this one.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Cue us up. Yeah, we love these guys. We have, okay, so these questions came in from SoundCloud, from email, from Twitter, from the main CinemaSins Twitter, from Facebook. Like, we literally get things from everywhere. So contact us however you want to. We will find them, and we will eventually answer them.
And we will kill them.
So keep them coming. These are all great, man. Don't ever think that we've answered so many questions that mine doesn't even register, because there's always an angle that we haven't thought about. And so we got some good ones for you today.
By the way, Barrett, I'm sorry, I should have waited until you were completely done, but I didn't want you to get into the questions immediately, and I didn't have a chance to ask. Mm-hmm. Do we have stuff from Discord in this? Like Discord?
Not in this one.
Discord asks a lot of questions too, and I've been neglecting to copy and paste them. If you want me to start doing that, I can do it easily. But
Discord. These motherfuckers were playing Guess the Goofs the other day on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is one of the coolest things I've ever fucking seen. I snuck in there and eavesdropped for a while, and that they saw me because I didn't know how it worked. And I thought I could eavesdrop, but like within 5 seconds, Joseph said, "Oh, hi, Jeremy." And then I had to acknowledge that I was there. Then they asked if I wanted to play, and I was like, "No. I don't want to beat all of you that badly."
That's right. That's right.
And it was great. They were having there was like, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 8 of them in there. I saw a bunch that had messaged that they couldn't make it this time, but I guess they're going to do it on the regular. I think that's neat as hell.
Yeah. Yeah. Discord doesn't let you be an anonymous bear or snake or whatever the hell.
No. I was schooled and fooled.
That's right. You were like Drax in, Infinity War or Endgame, where he's like, "I've been standing here for an hour." Yeah. I'm invisible.
You would never hear me. I am too quiet. Discord, I know you've been asking questions and everything. We don't go there often, especially I don't, unless somebody's actually tagged me, and I always forget that there's this whole channel dedicated to asking questions. Some of you have gone and asked them in other areas, and we still get to those, but I just need to remember at this point to get all those off of Discord. So I'm sorry to the Discord community. We need to we'll do a better job next time.
We will get you back.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, we'll probably do an all Discord question and answer thing at some point.
Yeah, we need to make it up to those guys.
All right. So here's the first one, baby. What are the best examples of older movies that you feel were ahead of their time, even by today's standards?
Older
movies. Personal example. This is an interesting one. I've seen this movie. Best of the Best in 1989. Mm-hmm. There is no singular protagonist, incredibly diverse cast on the American team, an action scene involving the entire team in which you can see where everyone is, realistic racism that gets reduced to a non-zero sum, open platonic male friendships, no one gets the girl, and spoiler, the heroes don't win by traditional standards. Best of the best, folks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think of older movies that were clearly ahead of their time?
Yeah.
Woefully misunderstood this question.
Uh-oh. For me, it's A Face in the Crowd, the Andy Griffith movie that he did with Elia Kazan before I think Griffith was even famous at all.
Oh.
The movie sort of predicts the arrival of someone like Donald Trump in politics. Someone who at the beginning of the movie is being bailed out of jail, but by the end of it is a national superstar that people tune into every night or whatever. By the end of the movie, he's got some political aspirations, but those get killed before spoiler alert, those get killed before he gets a chance to. But the fact is that it's a guy who comes in and he's just, I'm just saying what people want to hear and what people like to hear, so that it sounds like I'm such a good guy. And I think the Simpsons sort of parodied this with the puppet Gabbo, where the Gabbo is one of these kinds of characters. And then when he doesn't know that he's on television, he starts saying all these terrible things about his audience, which is what Andy Griffith does at the end of A Face in the Crowd, and what starts putting him on a downward spiral.
This is pre-TV Andy Griffith, right?
He's not. He hasn't done Andy Griffith's show yet. That's for sure.
Yeah.
This came out in 1957. Just the idea of someone who comes in and makes you feel good if you have these kind of, you know, whatever. And he's way more down home folksy than Donald Trump was, but it's the same sort of deal. You know, people who come on the scene and say stuff that, oh, this really relates to me, even though that person may not even have the same life as you do. And just comes out with some things. Oh yeah, that's something I agree with or whatever. And it's frightening. This is one of the most, this is definitely, I think, Andy Griffith's best performance ever. And this is a guy who had, you know, two huge hit TV shows in his life. you see him go from this humble guy to this like out of control monster by the end of it. Hard to think of Andy Griffith that way, but he really does pull it out. And it's, you know, and if he had done this after Andy Griffith, maybe it wouldn't have been the same kind of movie.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. Now, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was thinking about Bob Roberts.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, you're good. You're good. We both thought the same thing.
Well, no, I actually thought about with the beginning of this, I thought about Citizen Kane, which is about William Randolph Hearst, essentially. It's like, you know, The Master is not about L. Ron Hubbard, right? Mm. You know, Citizen Kane. But it's also prescient when it comes to a fucking gazillionaire running as a populist candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And it never made sense to me until fairly recently. Anyway, you know Bob Roberts better than I do, Jeremy, right?
I doubt it. I've seen it twice, maybe, but it did the whole what made me think of Bob Roberts was when you were talking about the Trump similarities. Only Bob Roberts is a much more polished politician. He's a folk singer, and so he's singing these right-wing songs against weed and premarital sex, but he's also behind the scenes, he's a, you know, regular dirty politician. And that might be a very interesting double feature. I did not catch the old movie that was ahead of its time.
Before you get into that, we've done a politics movie thing way back in, I think it was 2016, actually.
Mm.
And several of these movies have this kind of a theme. You have a face in the crowd. The Candidate with Robert Redford is another one where you have a candidate mm-hmm. who decides he's going to start talking about things that only he's very boring as a politician. So he has to start going against his own ideology or whatever, so that he can get more votes and more momentum in his campaign. You mentioned Bob Roberts, and then there's Bullworth, which is another one where Warren Beatty starts, he realizes that, you know, political campaigns are money machines for, you know, news corporations, talk about conspiracy theories. He starts talking in a way that, he A, realizes it's all bullshit, but B, he's also hitting the right points with the voters that he wants to get. So Bullworth is another one of those. So anyway, mm-hmm. not to interrupt you, go ahead.
No, you're good. Okay, so I didn't prepare for the question correctly, so my answers are not appropriate. Still going to give them because I'm one third of this show. Mm-hmm. So from a technological standpoint, I just glazed over the question, saw ahead of the time, and wrote down The Matrix. It is my favorite movie of all time.
Yo, that's old at this point. That's fucking 22 years old. That's old.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Just means that I'm old. But that's from like messaging ahead of their time rings super true now, I think of WALL-E, and I think of V for Vendetta. Sorry, asker of the question, that I did not quite grasp the spirit of the question. I'd have done more research and come up with something awesome. black and white and old, but I'll do better in the future.
I think that's still pretty old, man.
Thank you.
No,
thank
and
you
I think that. Those work too, because the Matrix definitely then influenced a whole bunch of stuff afterwards. And
yeah.
So if you wanted to point to a movie that was that you know we derive a lot of things from since it came out, Matrix would be a hit, would be high up on that ladder there.
The question asker gave an example that was only 10 years ahead of that, of The Matrix from 1989, Best of the Best. By the way, I want it on the record that A, Best of the Best is featured on Netflix right now.
Nice.
B, it features a young, almost Johnny Deppy, Eric Roberts as the lead in this martial arts thing.
Johnny
Deppy. You also have... he's got the mullet, but it's pulled back into a ponytail. You know the ponytail mullet? He's got the ponytail mullet, and he's all slicked and everything. He's all oily on his chest.
Yeah, man.
It's fucking rad. Chris Penn is in this, and Jimmy Earl Jones is the coach. Jimmy.
I love me some Chris Penn.
Yeah, me too. Me too. He's good.
Where did he go?
He's dead.
He's dead?
What? Yeah. Who?
Oh, shit.
Chris Penn is dead.
Oh, I thought you were saying James Earl Jones, and I was like, no, he's very much
my alive. Favorite pen is still Michael. Oh, he died in 2006. I'm serious. Michael is the singer.
He did the score with Paul Thomas Anderson, Magnolia.
Stuff
like that. Yeah.
He's good. And he's better than Sean, and he's alive.
Okay.
I'm glad we got all that cleared up.
Here we go. I'll be quick with mine. As far as older movies that are ahead of their time, I have to shout out 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
I'm so jealous of Chris to see this. You didn't see it in IMAX, right? It was just was it in IMAX in New York?
It was in fucking IMAX, man.
Ooh. Yeah, and it was giant, right?
Oh, it was like being in space.
God damn. You saw that. I think it was the day that Jeremy and I went back and you had a day and went to see that. And holy shit. I mean, I'd love this movie if I'm watching it on my phone, which I would never do. But even if I did, I would love this movie. The effects, man, it's unfucking believable how well these effects hold up.
Mm-hmm.
When you do practical stuff, folks, that's. I watched Jurassic Park the other night. Yeah, it's been playing on HBO all the time.
Yeah, it has.
And God damn, every fucking time I'm like, how did they do this?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Those first two look better than every other one that's come since. It's unreal.
Yeah. It's pretty clear that when Stan Winston died, a lot of his knowledge went with him, because not many people have been able to replicate it.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just it's crazy. But 2001 is, you know, for story, score, conception, everything, it's way ahead of its time. But you've heard me talk about that before.
It's a little ahead of its time in the fact that you had somebody writing a novel and somebody making a movie at the same time.
Yeah.
Almost never happens.
Exactly. And I'll save that for another time, but I'm cheating on a couple of these too. You know, Jeremy and I have talked about our love for The Real World, the show that was on MTV starting in 92. The first season of that show, it's a parody now. Chappelle's Show, everybody's made parodies of The Real World at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so prescient in its time. They were having conversations about race, they were having conversations about gender and LGBTQ stuff, and so much so that they brought the original cast back 30 years later and did like a homecoming, quote unquote homecoming show.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally had the same conversations between a few of them that they had 30 years prior.
Jesus.
So The Real World is as mocked as it is and as responsible as it is for the reality show glut that we have, was also ahead of its time in exposing these issues. So yeah, I think that would qualify. Right, the last one is I'll just throw it out there is La Traviata. It's an opera from Giuseppe Verdi. But I was watching Pretty Woman fairly recently, mm-hmm. and the opera that Richard Gere takes Julia Roberts to when she's in the beautiful fly red dress and everything is La Traviata, and it's about a dude that falls in love with a hua. Mm-hmm. And they end up together. Where have you also heard this? Moulin Rouge. So like that was one back in 1850s where it was so much of a story that Baz Luhrmann decided, hey, I'm going to adapt that in, what was that, 2000?
Yeah, it was 2001. Yeah, it was 2001.
So not that long ago, folks. So it's definitely enduring.
I also thought during this question of the Warriors, because it was a movie where all the street gangs in New York decided that they shouldn't be the enemies of each other, and that they believed the police to be the true enemy in the city. You know, obviously there's some disagreement in there, and the movie's not about that, but that's why everybody, all the gangs get together at the beginning of the movie. That's another one that I feel like has some prescience to it as well.
Who was the big name in the Warriors? C. Thomas?
Oh, no. The biggest name is James Remar.
Oh, it wasn't. C. Thomas was in The Outsiders.
Yeah. I mean,
and with Ralphie Macchio and Ponyboy.
Yeah,
and,
The Outsiders was sort of the all time everybody who was anybody young acting tried out for The Outsiders, and a lot of them got in, but there were a lot of others who tried to get into that too that became names later.
Nice. All right, you ready for the next one?
Yeah.
Let's do it. What is a movie that you disagree with thematically or morally, but still think is great?
I tell you what, I'm going to come up with a movie that if I watch now, I might not think is great anymore. But when I watched it back in the late 90s, In the Company of Men is one of these movies.
That's a good
Neil LaBute. Neil LaBute did this movie, and from what I understand, he's a big, huge asshole. But I don't know if he's ever been accused of anything big. But I know he was trending at one point during.
Well, and listen, his last name is French for the butt.
Oh yeah, totally, for sure. Anyway, the movie In the Company of Men, it's Aaron Eckhart before he's famous. And Matt Malloy, who he's been in a ton of stuff. You've seen him before. And the best thing that I can come up with is Election. He's in Election. He's one of the like school administrators or something. You see him at the end of that where they find out Matthew Broderick threw the vote in the trash. And there's a whole bunch of people flashing up on the screen. He's one of them in that. He's an Election. But anyway, it's Aaron Eckhart, who's just an absolute asshole in this movie. I don't think he has any good in him in the entire movie. He comes up with this plan that they should date the same woman and break up with her and destroy her life, basically. And the woman is played by Stacey Edwards, who you may recognize from Superbad, who's Michael Sarah's mom in Superbad. Mm. She is playing a deaf character. So, of course, the movie goes through a lot of jokes about that, about her being deaf. And it also has racial issues in it as well. There's a point where I think it's the only black character in this movie, says something about I'll axe about it, and mm-hmm. and Aaron Eckhart's like, the word is ask, and stuff like that, and there are moments that are just really, really like just super mean in the movie. But if you're portraying two people who are the lowest of the low, I think this is as brutally honest as it gets. You watch it at your own peril, because there's gonna be a lot of things, especially today, that is super offensive to you. If I watched it today, would I consider this something that's necessary, that you need to have, you know, you need to have this kind of a movie out there or whatever? I don't know. I haven't seen it in forever, but I remember enjoying it at the age of 20 and thinking, wow, how fucking frank this shit is. That's one of them. If I wanted to get off of this ledge here where I'm like, you know, people are like, in the company of men, the fuck is wrong with you, Chris? I would go with Goodfellas.
I'm glad you said that. I was going to put that on there. Mm-hmm. But I thought you explain your reasons and I'll not interrupt you, because I thought it was fascinating that you put this.
Yeah. I mean, you take a look at it. Any kind of gangster film, any kind of crime film is going to make these people the good guys in this. So you kind of flipped into this whole thing where you're like, oh yeah, way to go with the Latanza heist, guys. And you're like, wait a minute. that's a crime. You just committed a crime. These people are are reprehensible in every way. We see the life of Henry Hill at the beginning, and the movie makes you have sympathy for him because his dad beats him at the beginning of the movie. And so I think unconsciously you start thinking, well, this guy isn't all that bad. He's a product of his environment and so on and so forth. But he's maybe the best of the worst out of this, because he's got at least some conscience. So you don't see him killing people, but this is also coming from Henry Hill himself, this whole story. He makes himself look like a good guy in this, where he's really not. And everybody around him is awful. Joe Pesci's awful. Obviously, he's just an awful, awful person. But meanwhile, it's a riveting movie to watch. It's great to watch. But at the same time, you know, check your morals, man. You don't want to be
morally.
Like,
I mean, Scorsese, and God bless him, he's made a career off of it. He's made great movies, but he glorifies the violence and the crime.
So. I think so. Yeah. So,
hey, did Neil LaBute do Your Friends and Neighbors?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is another movie that's just got absolutely mean dialogue in it. One of the biggest scenes in the movie is Jason Patrick talking about how he and his buddies raped a guy in the shower, and it's played for, I guess, like, it's played for laughs because it has it's him, Aaron Eckhart, and Ben Stiller are all in the locker room trying to outdo each other with stories. And Patrick is like, you guys don't tell me anything about your lives. You guys are fucking boring. Like, why do I even hang out with you? And so Patrick goes into this deep story about that and everything. Ben Stiller's been fucking Aaron Eckhart's wife. I think it's Amy Brenneman. Aaron Eckhart after this starts teasing Ben Stiller, like, oh, you don't get any, you're not cool and all that. And Ben Stiller is like, hey, well, I fucked your wife. What do you think about that?
And then he fucking walks off.
He walks away. And then Jason Patrick is like, that beats my story.
Beats my story.
Yeah.
God, that whole thing, man. And like you, I liked that movie. That it was a 98 or so. And because it's I think it's Eckhart that goes first. And he says that jerking off is his favorite.
Yeah.
Thing. And then it's got Jason Patrick doing this terrible, terrible story.
Right.
And then it's got Ben Stiller with that like coda. And it's like, God, everybody is. It's like the worst of Woody Allen love triangles, romantic entanglements, like boiled down to even worse people.
Right. It's it really seems like he's trying to like out mean his dialogue and everything, where he's just trying to be just super mean. And again, I even bring up these two movies. I mean, they're way out of date. You definitely couldn't come out with something like this now, because you, I mean, it's just, it, you can't play shit like that for laughs. You just can't.
What you got, Jeremy?
I first wrote down, I have real answers, but my, I first wrote down, honestly, any movie that has a happy ending, life fucking sucks, dog.
Right.
So anytime the guy gets the girl at the end, all I remember is the girls that dump me. Anyway, I have two answers. One is The Score, which is a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it is.
But at the end of the day, we're rooting for one thief to steal a multi-million dollar priceless artifact over a different thief who wants to steal it just because that different thief tried to fuck over the first thief. Like, that is a happy ending, but those are some high end, like, at least in Heat, they get caught or die, except for Val Kilmer. I guess he walks, but like the,
Val Kilmer.
No, I'm saying Val Kilmer, he walks in Heat, doesn't he?
He gets killed, doesn't he?
No, he drives up and Ashley Judd does the wave, and then he's got a fake ID, and he drives away.
Oh, I got you. I got that confused with The Town.
Oh, The Town. Yeah.
Anyway,
the same they have similarities. Well, they have similarities.
And again, The Town is the same. Is has the same problem, is that we're rooting for a bad guy. At least in right. Heat, the movie is not saying the bad guys are the heroes. The other one I wrote down is Arrival, just because I've slowly come around to my wife's position on Amy Adams' character's decision to go ahead and have that kid she knows is going to die of cancer. And I'm never going to agree with that decision, but I still love the movie and I still watch it.
The question though is in Arrival, if she doesn't do it, does she solve the
problem?
That's
the argument. Yeah, no, I agree with. I
and
agree
is that
that's
problem
there.
Is that problem greater than her child suffering? I guess is the
It is a murky discussion worthy film for sure, and you can definitely take that angle. I hear you.
Yeah,
yeah. As I mentioned, Woody Allen before, Manhattan is a gorgeous film. Black and white, has the Rhapsody in Blue at the beginning. It is a love letter to Manhattan. That middle scene, you know, everybody remembers Annie Hall, and I love Annie Hall. But that middle section where Woody Allen is hanging out with Diane Keaton, they're not even in a relationship at this point. But they walk all over Manhattan. Probably, and Chris could dissect it, but probably impossibly so. It may be like a Ferris Bueller in Chicago type of situation. There's no way that they made it from MoMA all the way down to fucking Battery Park, you know, within the span of a night or whatever.
Right.
But you know, it's gorgeous. What it centers around, obviously, well, it centers around a lot of relationships. Everybody's fucking everybody who's fucking everybody. But the relationship with Mariel Hemingway, is even in the movie, it's troubling. She's 17 years old, but she's not even, how do I say this right? She is so infantile and so juvenile as portrayed in the movie that it almost makes it even more reprehensible. In the way that her character is played. In fact, that's the quote emotional payoff at the end of the movie, is that he doesn't want her to get corrupted by going to London to study, you know, the arts and everything. And her response is that not everybody is corrupted. And that's supposed to make you feel good, people, that the Woody Allen character is in his 40s at this time is going down to relink up with his 17-year-old girlfriend. And she assures him that she's not going to be impured. You see what I'm saying? Anyway, it's a masterpiece cinematically. Everything about it and around it is skeezy. And I'll also throw in The Clockwork Orange, A Clockwork Orange, not The Clockwork Orange. That's the sequel.
Right.
You've seen A Clockwork Orange. Now witness The Clockwork Orange.
See, it makes it different.
Our shit's different. Clockwork Orange is much like Goodfellas, to where I can't tell whether Kubrick at the time was celebrating the heresy or satirizing it. Mm-hmm. And I've gone back and forth as people much smarter than me have done many, many times to see what the point is. I think we have a good grasp of what the point of the book was, but I think the movie leaves it a little bit more, you talk about murky. Mm-hmm. It is a stone cold classic. That first opening scene at the milk bar with the droogs is indelible. It will mm-hmm. always be indelible. But the movie, it's got some stuff.
It's got some brutal stuff in it for sure. And a lot of times you watch it and you're like, is Kubrick playing this up for how gross it is? Or is he playing it up for laughs? Maybe it's hard to know, sometimes.
Yeah. It's certainly not clear.
Yeah, because he's sitting there singing in the rain while he's doing all this, and it's just, God, I mean, it's so gross. I mean, I'm sure if you ask Kubrick, he's like, of course it's gross. Look at what's on the screen. But it feels a little bit more exploitative than that, you know?
It so. Does, and when he's supposedly getting his comeuppance at the same place at the end, mm-hmm. feels very hollow to me, because I don't know who we're supposed to be rooting for.
Here. Right.
But it is beautiful. It's a great movie and great soundtrack. And I'm looking at the poster right now. Mm-hmm. It is gorgeous. But yeah, there's some shit in there. All right, next one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just gonna go right down the row, baby. That's how I roll. I ain't scared,
baby.
What are some aspects or scenes in film that you feel are not talked about enough? This person has great examples, interestingly. For example, in Upgrade, love that movie, yeah. The main character has to perform these elaborate fight scenes, yet still maintain that they are surprised at what is happening because they're not in control of their body. Who is that? Logan Marshall Green?
Yep.
He is so fucking good in that. He's every bit as good as Tom Hardy is in Venom, I think,
mm-hmm.
In terms of what the fuck is going on, but also I'm kind of liking this, but yeah. Also, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Fucking love that movie. You love that movie, right, Jeremy?
Oh man. I specifically love this aspect that he's doing these things while being shocked and amazed at these things. And even at one point apologizes to one guy he's beating up. Yeah, I love that.
But there are some times where you see like a little bit of joy in there, right? Where he's holy fuck.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. what I'm saying. He has a range of different he reacts to it the way someone watching a movie would react to it. But it's him. That's why I think the acting performance is incredible, because Logan Marshall Green actually had to do this at the same time. You're watching the movie, you're already fooled into thinking there's some computer chip controlling his body. But that was the actor doing that and reacting to it. It, with surprise, I think it's probably a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, it's solid. And the other example that this person gives is how Michael J. Fox was able to, quote, stay angry during the filming of Teen Wolf, so he did not change back into a human.
Jesus.
that is a great, yes, that is a great moment in movie history where Michael J.
Like
Fox decided to do that.
It's like how Darth Vader was able to avoid actually injuring anybody with his lightsaber during the filming.
Really?
Of
it's crazy.
Yeah.
He's sitting there smoking a cigarette on break. He's like, God damn, glad I didn't chop anybody up.
That's right. I need to keep this wolf-like appearance. If I don't, then I'll go back to my old Michael J. Fox. In the same vein as that Logan Marshall Green thing, Vincent D'Onofrio in Men in Black.
Yes.
Once the alien gets inside his skin, now has to sort of like walk around in this, what would an alien do if they got into somebody's skin and walked around in it? It's such a weird and fun, delightful type of thing to watch him walk around town, like, you know, moving his head in an odd angle and this weird way he's walking all the way through, and this weird thing where he's talking like this all the way through it, you know. It's a wonderful performance, and I don't think Vincent D'Onofrio gets enough credit for it a lot of time. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, in Airplane, nobody gives away the joke ever. There's never a time where somebody gives away the joke. This is an underrated thing for a lot of parody movies. The Zucker brothers were all, and Jim Abrahams were obviously all great at making these movies until the 90s, where everybody started trying to make them and they thought they knew what this was all about. And then you had the Friedberg Seltzer crew come in and just totally wreck the genre forever. When nobody gives away the joke, when you just say something that's odd or do something that's odd, and then just don't smile or look at the camera or have somebody tell you that's weird or say something weird and say sorry after that, which I hate that shit more than anything in comedies in general, where somebody says something fucking weird and then they have to say sorry after it so that they can tell the audience, I was just joking, that was just a joke, blah, blah, blah. Fuck you. Just say the thing and walk away. So a lot of the imitators, even Zucker, even there's even that moment in Basketball, and that was Zucker who did that. There's a moment where there's that point where they're doing the unsolved mysteries thing, and she says, I would suggest if you're looking for whoever Trey Parker's playing, you look in the lowest, darkest area possible with no human, just like this horrible, desolate, you know, thing that she's describing. And then Robert Stack goes, scenario number one, he went to Disney World. They should just cut it there. Don't let him do anything. But Robert Stack makes this motion with his head like, I just said something really fucked up. And if he doesn't do that, that joke is sold so much better. And I know David Zucker probably looked at that going, I should cut it off here. But I imagine it was probably weird to cut him off where he was cutting him off. So like he couldn't do it. But like, that's what I'm saying. Is the Airplane, just nobody ever gives it away. Everybody's just acting like this is the normal thing to do. So anyway,
which is funny because Robert Stack is so great at that, normally of not going over and above to sell the joke.
Right.
You look at his voice performance in Beavis and Butthead Do America. he's fucking Airplane. For God's sakes, you know,
in Airplane, he's got those moments where it's like, you know, should we turn on the runway lights? He's like, no, that's just what they're expecting us to do. And there's no other. It just stays on him. He's very serious about it. So anytime you see a parody movie or any kind of comedy where people are just kind of like doing these little things to make sure that the audience knows that we were just kidding, it just is. It's a big turnoff for me, especially that in animated comedies do this all the time where somebody says something weird and somebody goes, sorry, stop saying sorry. Stop fucking saying sorry all the time after you say something fucked up. So anyway,
that's your PSA, kids.
Yeah,
that's right. That's correct.
Yeah, it is. I have once again failed to understand the question correctly.
Just get a clip of that. Just put it in. Mm-hmm. Like how people loop music. Just throw that in.
I do have an answer written down. I'm going to share. And then I have another answer I think is a better, more appropriate answer. The first answer I wrote down is that scene in Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, where the main character gets asked all the questions and the camera just stays on her face the whole time. And the questions go from fairly innocuous, like how often do you have sex? I mean, she's at a place to get an abortion, so that question is innocuous there. But then it gets into stuff like, does your partner hit you? Have you ever been forced to have sex? And you see her face change as she answers these questions. She's always got to say, you know, never, rarely, sometimes, always, is the four options for the answer. And I'm always amazed by this scene because this is not an actress. This is a singer that the director went and found and said, I want you to be in my movie. And she just nails this scene. Mm-hmm. And it's baffling to me. But the other one that I think understands the question better in the response is the prison Harley fight scene in Birds of Prey. Which I tweeted about it once and caught some heck because people didn't pay attention to what I was trying to say. And Twitter is not the place to give nuanced takes. But
what?
There's like no cutting in so much of that fight. There's so little cutting, I should say. It should shame the MCU. Now, I realize part of this is Margot Robbie. She apparently, in the new Suicide Squad movie, actually did the thing with the toes and the key and actually unlocked the thing. Like she.
Oh, shit. Seriously?
And there's another story James Gunn told about a thing she didn't know how to do. And she said, let's do it tomorrow. And she came back the next day and had mastered this one move.
Holy shit.
I have a feeling there's a lot more to her than anybody knows.
Yeah,
She's all in on these things.
I think, and she apparently has a very unique ability that maybe not every MCU star does. So let's give some of the credit to her. But I don't feel like anybody, even the people who I see talking about Birds of Prey, are not talking about the lack of cuts in that fight scene. They're talking about the egg sandwich or, you know, the end with the big carnival fight. But I don't see anybody talking about that. But I feel like that was a masterclass. I almost feel like whoever directed that was giving the finger to the MCU with that particular sequence, saying, here's how you can shoot action where everybody knows where everybody is, and you can do it with style. But it doesn't have to cut every 2 seconds. Anyway.
Yeah, it was Kathy Yan who did Birds of Prey.
That's right.
She also did that Dead Pigs movie, which is spectacular. That was
recommending that.
Yeah, she is like you think about Chloe Zhao getting the Eternals. Like, I would love to see more of Kathy Yan doing stuff like that.
Dead Pigs was the original name of my church youth group thrash band.
Yeah.
Because that time where Jesus set the pigs off the cliff into the water and all those pigs died.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The wrong pig died. All right, my aspects, it's not a performance, but it's stuff that I've been thinking about lately, is lighting is one of them. We do these frame by frame breakdowns of movies for CinemaSin so often, and there are so many times, I can't imagine how many times you guys have seen this, where especially horror movies where it's just fucking pitch black, and you're like, if somebody's watching this video on a phone, you know, if I can't see it on a giant monitor, and I wrote it. how is this person going to see what we're talking about here? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll have to make adjustments. But God, fucking lighting, bad lighting really stands out to me these days, especially in something like horror films where it's used as a crutch. It's, you know, there are times where Andy Muschietti uses it in It Chapter One, where it's in that Pennywise slide projector scene where it's perfect, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then there are times in It Chapter Two, also Andy Muschietti, where it's super fucking dark, and it's obviously obscuring special effects. It's obscuring something. But man, it freaks me out. And the other time that I noticed it was recently, for some reason, the entire CinemaSin staff almost watched the Malice at the Palace documentary on Netflix, which is about the Detroit Pistons, Indiana Pacers brawl that went into the stands. And for some reason, all of the interviews with the players were filmed in this weird film noir aesthetic.
Basement dungeons. They were all filmed in basement dungeons.
Did anyone else did it bother anyone else besides me?
It bothered me.
It did, because like Reggie Miller is a great looking dude. He's under the lights every big NBA game as an announcer. Why are you filming him with like this super huge shadow coming across his face?
It's because this is my greater point. You know my point, that the cinematic techniques are creeping into documentaries as a form of persuasion. This documentary knows exactly what it wants you to feel and believe when it's done. And the lighting is part of that, I think. Just like the jerseys hanging in midair at supposedly their home neighborhoods, or the TVs yeah. in the middle of neighborhood courts playing footage of the brawl.
Yeah.
It's
random swimmers.
That's why I joke they probably had storyboards for this thing. Because the lighting was way dramatic, and I think took a little something away from it instead of adding to it. But every single one of them was lit dark as hell. Ben Wallace was almost darker than Reggie Miller.
Yeah, it's just a weird aesthetic choice, and you're right, but put a fucking ring light up there and just have them stare into it for
a couple
hours. Used to shoot depositions and everything, and one of the first things they told me to do or not to do was to like zoom in when people are talking and all sorts of little, you just keep the camera static the whole time. because there's the inherent need of people to like, oh, I want to do something stylish here. And like, you know, and
I want to put some flair on this deposition.
Right. And that was understood before they told me that, but at the same time, I feel like there probably are people who get into this and like, well, this is the best job I can get using a camera. So, and I'll really pizzazz this thing up with some zooms and some wipes and shit. And,
wipes.
Some cross dissolves. The documentaries do the same thing, and that's why, anytime you watch one of these, you've got to understand that there's a lot of information that they leave on the cutting room floor a lot of times that could help with context of things. They have a narrative that they want to go with on these things, and that's why, you know, when I watched that Val documentary, I was like suspicious of you know, him being portrayed in such a great light in everything. I mean, again, they showed some negative portions of it, but like, you know, it's very, very precisely cut and edited so that you could, you know, make sure that, oh, yeah, that guy is not as bad as we think he is. So any documentary these days I watch, I have that, you know, what is the style that's going on here? Is that coloring my perspective of what's going on?
So you didn't, when they asked a real tough question, you didn't zoom in on their eyes like they do in like Reality Bites, or like
you should go over, you reach your hand up on the camera and that little knob that zooms in, and you just kind of like, okay, let's see how slow I can do this. Will people even notice it? Will people notice it? They'll notice it when it's all the way up on his lips. Yeah.
Or Sex, Lies, and Videotape, they do that too. Jimmy Spader gets in there and like really focuses, like, how often do you have sex? And then he like zooms in on Annie McDowell, and she's like, what are you asking me that for?
Yeah. Do you think could you give me orgasms? And he's like, yeah.
that's a movie I really enjoyed, but I wonder how well that shit stands up these days.
Yeah, no telling.
That was Soderbergh's first feature, wasn't it? Like his first big one.
First big one. I think he had done a couple of other things before that, but that was his first one that sort of broke out. It's one of the movies that they point to that started the whole indie movement in the 90s. All right, everybody, it's time to talk about BetterHelp.
Yeah, BetterHelp. BetterHelp.
BetterHelp.
Mm-hmm. You want to feel better, right, listener? I mean, listen. Maybe you're feeling okay, but you could always feel better. Maybe you're feeling not so great and you could feel better. Go to BetterHelp. This is an online counseling service that helps with a variety of issues. You got your stress, you got your anger, you got your depression, you got your sadness, you got your anxiety, worry. It goes on and on and on. Addiction, identity issues. There's a lot going on out there, folks. This is not the best time in the world right now, to be honest with you, environmentally. And if you're having trouble dealing with everything, or if you're having internal struggles, look to some help. I am some evidence that this stuff can work. It's online counseling. It's so easy. You go to your BetterHelp.com and you sign up. You answer a few questions, you get matched to a counselor within 24 hours, and then you're on your way. Everything is set up through your own counseling room, scheduling, communication. It is so easy, and you can set up your sessions to be video chats or text chats or however you want to do it. It's available on your tablet or your phone or your laptop. This is a godsend of a service, especially right now. It's fantastic.
I have a friend. I haven't seen him in a while, but he used to say, why should I pay somebody to tell me what I'm thinking? And that used to annoy me because it's kind of a misunderstanding of therapy, mm-hmm. but also it's not. Like, these are licensed professional therapists. They've been trained to understand how the human brain works and how some of these different disorders work, and trained in how to help you pull it out of your own brain and come face to face with it, make peace with it, and start moving forward. That's what they do. It's not as simple as just telling you what you're thinking, but it's helping you understand what you're thinking. They're as much of a tour guide or a Sherpa, if you will, as they are anything else. And the journey is super fulfilling, I promise you.
It is. And you need to work with these licensed professional Sherpas to mm-hmm. take you up the mountain mm-hmm. to your... I couldn't let that go without calling out the Sherpas. They are Sherpas. Be a yeah. beacon.
Be a beacon.
and give him help. All right. Anyway, BetterHelp.com/Sincast. Go to that URL, okay? You get 10% off your first month. Use the junk out of that first month, guys. I mean, this is and beyond, but certainly the first month, where you can really, really get in touch with what's going on with you so that you and your Sherpa can figure out the journey ahead to help you deal with these issues, okay? This is I'm joking around, but I'm not about the actual mental health portion of this. It is a lifesaver. It's a godsend, and it's fantastic. BetterHelp.com/Sincast. Go there right now. Let's jump around just a little bit and clear out some deck here, because we had a question about some CinemaSins content last week about the apple and the asshole. Which member of your team taught a college class in web development without actually knowing about it, as referenced in the very first or the first video in which y'all send y'all selves?
That was me.
It was me.
Yeah.
That is Jeremy who taught that class. Here's the deal. It started, I probably told this story before, but I love it, so I'm going to tell it again. It started with me teaching Microsoft Publisher, which I did know very well. And it was like a part-time adjunct gig at a community college here in Central Tennessee. Paid me like, I think, $400 a month.
Nice.
And I went like once a week. I had a class.
Solid.
I had a class of like five students.
Oh, seriously?
Yes. And, you know, that went fine. I'd absolutely nailed that. I knew Publisher. And then they said, hey, we're not going to offer a course on Publisher next semester. Do you know web development? What was the program that everybody used for web development in the early 2000s?
Was it Dreamweaver?
Dreamweaver. Mm-hmm. Do you know Dreamweaver? And I said, of course. And I had never used it. And so at this point in time, I desperately needed the gig. And so what I should have done is, you know, like, taught myself Dreamweaver, right? Like, I had a couple weeks. I didn't even do that. I just did the whole 40-year-old virgin thing. So, like, every time a student would ask a question, how do I
turn my text red, I would turn to the rest of the class and go, all right, class, how do we turn the text red?
No way.
This is DiCaprio in Catch Me If You Can type stuff.
Let one of them answer it. I did the whole semester. I had my boss, the dean, come and sit in on a class like he did every semester to evaluate me. And I had a better full-time job at the end of that semester, and I did not continue teaching there after that. But I successfully pulled it off. They kept asking me for my transcripts. I just never sent them. I think eventually they would have stopped paying me just because I couldn't prove some of these skills. But totally got one over.
It's funny. I also successfully did not learn Dreamweaver at my job shooting depositions, because there was a point where the guy who ran that video department was like, it would be cool if we could start getting a cool website for our business here and everything. And I was learning HTML at the time. So I was learning all the like down the nuts and bolts of HTML, how to make a website and everything. And I was putting all these little cool things in it. I still didn't understand a lot of things, but he wanted me to learn Dreamweaver for more dynamic things and stuff that you could just, you know, I guess, hey, I want this page to look like this. And you just press a button and you don't have to write the code and all that. But I was already so deep into the HTML stuff that I just completely ignored that thing. And it's not like this ended up being a big major argument between me and him later on, because I didn't learn that, but he never emphasized it. He never said, I need you to learn this. It's just that when I got to HTML and I started making a sample site and everything, he wanted me to do things to the site that, you know, stuff like when you reduce the window and you minimize the window, it all the whole page shows up in the minimum, you know, the minimum window and everything, instead of showing part of it, which was, you know, that was, I don't even know if that's a thing nowadays. I don't even know if you can do that on purpose with web pages, but I learned
where it just goes to a part of it.
Yeah, where it just goes to a part of it.
Yeah.
And I learned the HTML thing after we had the argument about me not doing Dreamweaver. I learned how to do it in HTML, but the damage was done. We'd already yelled at each other about all that. So, we have that somewhat in common. It's the reason why I knew the name of the thing that you were asking about.
All right, well, let's go to a new one, and then we'll get to some older ones here, because we've got some kicking around here. Favorite time an actor plays a parody of themselves, like Neil Patrick Harris in Harold and Kumar, or Carl Weathers in Arrested Development. Love that. I've been catching up on Arrested Development over the last few years, and I appreciate that.
What a great show. John Malkovich and Being John Malkovich is what I came up with here. Malkovich. Malkovich. I guess anytime someone plays themselves, they are a parody of themselves. Like, they hardly ever are what they really are. although this, I feel like, is like somewhat close, maybe, in certain things. Like when he's, you know, I always think about when we see Malkovich outside of when there's someone inside of him. Like he's doing that play. He's doing that Shakespeare play in the middle of Being John Malkovich, and Catherine Keener. I think it's Catherine Keener that shows up. And he's like, can I have 15 minutes, whatever the director is or whatever. He's like in the middle of this intense scene, and she shows up, and he's like, all right, 15 minutes, guys. Like, off. and just the funny stuff, like when he's in the cab and the cab driver's like, aren't you in that thief movie, that jewel thief movie? And he's like, I was never in a jewel thief movie. he's just, especially when he goes in and complains to Charlie Sheen, and Charlie Sheen also is playing himself in this movie, exactly the type of guy you think Charlie Sheen is in real life. where, you know, Malkovich is saying, like, there's something going on. It was, you know, I didn't know what was going on. Like, I think she's doing something to me. And he's like, oh, wow, it might be a witch cult, man, like a sex witch cult. You know, it's like, think about it. Two sexy witches trying to get, you know, like he's you know, stuff like that. But yeah, I'll go with Malkovich on this, although he is a lot of the times he's playing. This is another, maybe you could even put this in that category of people that we don't talk about this enough. He's playing the character of the person that's inside him a lot of times.
Yeah.
During that. And just all the stuff that he has to go through when, especially when someone first goes into him and everything, he's got that, he doesn't even know how to talk because the person inside of him is trying to figure out how to make him talk. That's a really underrated performance, probably, from Malkovich.
It is.
I go Bob Barker and Happy Gilmore every day because I love Happy Gilmore. And
Bob Barker's hilarious in that movie.
He's hilarious. He's game. And they even got him to say the price is wrong, bitch.
Yeah.
And do a fight scene. That was just, I thought.
Well,
that
he doesn't say it, does he? He doesn't say the price is wrong. It's Sandler that says that. And then.
What does he say? You're right. He says he cusses though, doesn't he?
Well, he says, after he beats him up after saying that, which by the way is my favorite part because he's lying there on the ground unconscious and Sandler says that thing. And then suddenly you just see him animated. His face lights up in anger and grabs a hold of Adam Sandler.
You just see the hand going out.
Yeah. Yeah. And he after he beats the hell out of him, he's like, I think you've had enough. And Sandler tries to get up again and kicks him one more time. And he's like, I think you've had enough, bitch.
Yeah. And then that's right.
Then you see him like practicing his punches as he walks away.
I knew they got him to say a cuss word. That's what I misremembered that line.
Yes.
I also don't think this is a great performance, but I love the Brett Favre cameo at the end of something about Mary.
Oh my God.
Mary, you know I'll always be true to you.
Nobody can ever execute that joke again without, it's so brilliant. We're going to just casually refer to this guy by his first name the whole movie. And then when he shows up at the end, it's going to be the most famous guy who has that first name. just loved it.
They did that with, what's his name from NSYNC? Lance Bass in Tropic Thunder. They did that.
Oh, yeah.
They did that later. That's right.
Lance, I mean, that was Al Pacino that was with Lance, right?
That's right. And he shows up, I think he shows up at the end. With him, I think.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. At the Oscars when Tug is getting his Oscar.
That's right. Would.
Everybody's gay sometimes.
Yeah, that's right, Mary. You know I'll always be true. Yeah,
oh,
it's
my
the worst
God,
performance
man.
Ever.
But he does have a good line reading though when they're like, what's Brett Favre doing here? And he's like, I'm playing the Dolphins, you dumbass.
It's so ridiculous. Anyway, as far as parody of themselves, you can't get better than This Is the End from like top to bottom. Like everybody in there, from Jay Baruchel doing his all shuck stuff, all the way up to James Franco doing his pretentious stuff, which I love. I mean, these are folks that are almost at the top of their celebrities. You got Rihanna in here. You got a lot of huge people in this at the time, and they are willing to just eviscerate themselves. And Jonah Hill, I would say Jonah Hill and James Franco really play up their pretension. Jonah Hill's got that earring and he's like, you know, I'm taking serious roles now and shit like that. He's always had this feud with Jay Baruchel. One of my sneaky favorite lines in this movie is when at the beginning party, when Mindy Kaling comes up to Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, and she's like, oh my God, if I don't fuck Michael Cera tonight, I'm going to blow my brains out.
What?
And they say the same things. They're like, what the fuck? And she's like, think about it. Hairless, skinny, probably has a huge cock. He's coked up right now. It's gonna be great.
There's some interesting things about that movie. I think a lot of the stuff that's in the movie, they played up a lot of their real life things that were going on with them at the time, not only what they were doing professionally, but how their relationships were with each other at the time. Cause there was really a, like a rivalry going on, and there were things that were tense about some of those guys' relationships in the movie that they played.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, watch the first 40 minutes of that movie. You don't need anything else from that movie. It's not terrible from the middle to the end, but do you guys agree? Like all the fun stuff is at the beginning, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say so. Although I love that nutty ass ending that they have in the movie.
Yeah, no, that's you're right. And they set it up with the Beastie Boys. That's hilarious. Backstreet Boys song at the beginning of it. But I think it's hilarious. Of course, Michael Cera is great in there. I love the time where he comes up to Christopher Mintz-Plasse and he's hey, does this Coke smell funny to you? And blows it in his face. and the scene is Michael Cera, Jonah Hill, and Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who, what is this, 10 years probably? No, it's probably, what, 4 or 5 years after Superbad, I guess.
Yeah, it's somewhere around that. It's somewhere around there, yeah.
Something like that. And it's funny to see them, but like Christopher Mintz-Plasse is like, I've never done cocaine before. What am I supposed to do? Michael Cera's like, I'll be your guide. It's okay, sweetie. I'll be your guide. Anyway, and I do want to shout out, because I watched this again fairly recently, all the Seinfeld cast in Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to watch the actual reunion show as part of Curb Your Enthusiasm. You guys have seen this, right? The Seinfeld reunion show.
No,
I haven't seen that episode. Or is it multiple episodes with each one, or is it all in?
Yeah, it's pretty much that whole season. I think it's season 6, something like that. It's at least the last Curb. Half of it.
I've seen a lot of Curb, but I don't think I've seen that. I've seen highlights from those. They even make a big joke about Michael Richards saying something inappropriate and
right. Yeah.
And, try to, I don't know, cleanse his image, I guess.
Yeah. And he slips back into Kramer beautifully, but seeing him and Seinfeld, and especially Jason Alexander, who is playing, of course, Larry David's, persona in Seinfeld. What's funny is how Jason Alexander, as himself, quote unquote, is taking over Larry David's life. Like he's flirting with Cheryl Hines, who is playing Larry David's wife in the show. And there's a lot of layers to it. And I think it's just absolutely brilliant. Jeremy, I can't believe you haven't watched this, because this would be so right up your alley.
I saw a few episodes of Curb, its first season, thought it was hilarious, and filed it as, I'll get to this show eventually. And I just haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah. No, I understand that. As a matter of fact, I've done the same thing. I've watched probably 15 episodes total, but I had to watch this whole Seinfeld arc that they had in there. It's fantastic.
It's probably one of your better cringy shows that go with cringe humor and things like that, because it's relatable things that you do, and then there, it's just like Seinfeld, only it feels like a realer type of thing or whatever, where what do you do in that situation? You know, what is it? How is it that you're supposed to act in this? Is everybody else crazy or am I crazy? And it plays really well that series does. But I can see people watching an episode or something and going, this is cringe humor, and just walking away. But I, as someone who doesn't really like cringe humor, I think this has a good balance to it.
Yeah. From everything I've seen, and I'm very much like Jeremy, where I loved it, but just didn't get to it. But I definitely figured out the whole Seinfeld thing. It's fantastic. Let's bounce around a little bit. You guys ready for a little bit more?
Sure.
Despite being a less stylish film, Boiler Room does a better job than Wall Street in showing how evil the finance sector is. What movie, despite not being as stylish, is far better at achieving its message than its counterpart?
I would say this is one of those questions where the answers are probably fewer and far, few and far between a lot of times, because you have to not only find a movie that's similar to a more popular movie, but they also have to be better than that movie in some way. And I don't think that happens often.
Right.
So I think a couple of mine, I think one of mine is kind of ridiculous, but let's go with it. Dances with Wolves over Avatar.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right.
I'm gonna wrap my head around that one.
You feeling me?
Yeah, I'm with you, man. I totally get it.
I mean, Avatar is obviously 800 other movies other than Dances with Wolves, but it's
Dances with Wolves.
It's definitely Dances with Wolves. Dances with Wolves, I don't think very many people would argue that Dances with Wolves is not superior to Avatar. They're definitely, everybody likes Dances with Wolves better, I think. But this is asking what's the less stylish film. And I would say Dances with Wolves doesn't have as much style as Avatar, but Avatar has way too much style probably. And not enough substance. But it's the same. Yeah, it is the same kind of story. You know, you have somebody who is outside of, another race of people and goes in and tries to live amongst them and trying to learn their ways and everything. And Dances with Wolves is obviously a way, way, way fucking better movie than Avatar.
That's awesome. So there you go. Sam Worthington never blew up after that.
Hang on,
did he?
Man. Well, these other avatars up. Are going to come, and he's going to be a huge star. Hang on.
I would say he did blow up because he was everything after Avatar. It's just that it never sustained after that. He had
he also made poor choices, like that Terminator. Reunion movie, whatever the fuck it's called.
Terminator Reunion. But he was in those like Clash of the Titans and Wrath of the Titans, and he would show up like just randomly in all these other movies, and it's like, God damn, Sam Worthington's in fucking everything. But it just didn't sustain, and I think a combination of things where maybe he just wasn't whatever it is that turns somebody into a superstar, it never happened. And the choices and all that all combined to, now I don't know what he's done lately, but,
I haven't seen him in a minute,
but, the other one. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to make a joke. It's not a good one. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. The other one that I thought of was Zero Effect over the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, 3,000%.
Sherlock Holmes obviously has a lot of style to it. Guy Ritchie behind the camera. Zero Effect is Jake Kasdan, and I think it's his first movie. Zero Effect is one of the best Sherlock Holmes that's not Sherlock Holmes movies you'll ever see. It's still perpetually underrated in my mind, but I like this movie. I will watch this movie 10 times before I watch Sherlock Holmes again.
A lot of Benny Stiller movies coming up today.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Mm.
Speaking of, I'm just going to drop this in real quick before I give my answers, but Wyatt Earp over Tombstone is my real answer to this question. But we've had that discussion. There's no reason to have it again. So I'm going to give you two other answers.
Bally Kilmer making a big show on this too.
Fucking guy.
Indeed. I like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels more than Snatch.
Yeah, that's a Guy Ritchie again.
Snatch is a weird film in that it's glossy grime. Like,
yeah,
it's still everybody in that, every place, every set, every person in that movie is dirty, like physically dirty. Just like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. But it's a glossy version of that. And it just feels more realistic in Lock, Stock that these bumbling criminals are real. And the ones in Snatch just feel more cinematic. I love both movies. And then I'm also going to go really weird and choose Hard Times over Training Day. Now, Training Day is amazing, and you know Denzel's my guy, so I'm not really saying I think it's a better movie.
King Kong doesn't have shit on him.
For real. But both movies are essentially saying, hey, a lot of cops are bad in L.A. And Harsh Times is way less stylish, way, you know, more guerrilla style, gritty. And Training Day has lots of style and substance. And I think the message, again, gets a little movie starred. And it becomes Training Day obviously turns into this Denzel vehicle, and he wins the Oscar and he deserves it. But, you know, the message is just a little bit glossier in that movie, whereas Harsh Times really just shows you how bleak that shit is. Mm-hmm. Because he's being, now he's not an officer, but he's being heavily recruited by the military, and he is unhinged. He is mentally imbalanced. That movie's way scarier to me than Training Day.
Yeah. Is that the one with Christian Bale?
Yeah, Christian Bale and Freddie Rodriguez.
So Denzel never shoved a catheter in his pee-pee to inject clean urine.
No, he did not. And of course, these, in addition to being similar films, these are both written by David Ayer, one directed by him. So there's a reason for the similarities.
Yeah, he's pushing that Ayer cut. He's out there. Getting that out there.
But I tweeted the other day, I was just making a joking observation, that Free Guy made $26 million and was considered a hit, and The Suicide Squad made $26 million and was considered a flop. Yeah. And the Snyder Bros found that tweet. Yeah. A bunch of low-level ones with 1,000 or 2,000 followers. I had to mute that tweet because they're so pro-Ayer and Ayer cut, they are actively bashing this James Gunn version. Wow. And so they all came in with, well, The Suicide Squad was blah, 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 and it had blah, 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 and it's superheroes and blah, 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 blah. And I was so tired of that shit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. I got to rewatch Harsh Times. I remember liking that movie a lot, but yeah, it's tough. Bleak. It's harsh.
It could be an answer to that question earlier about a movie with immoral people that you still really like.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to go with Shakespeare and say that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead is vastly superior to even a movie that I really like, Mel Gibson's Hamlet, which came out the same year,
but
which
not
was not
Kenneth
directed
Branagh.
I'm sorry.
Would you say that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead is better than the Branagh version of Hamlet?
Absolutely, I would.
Okay.
Absolutely, I would. I think it gets the point of, it's a different point, but it's obliquely getting towards, you know, the fact that the prince is glum.
right.
It was Franco Zeffirelli that did the quote Mel Gibson version, yes, of Hamlet. Now, I love the Zeffirelli, I'll call it the Zeffirelli version of Hamlet. And I love the Branagh version of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. But I have watched Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead a zillion more times, even though it involves the same characters peripherally, because it's just so smart and it's so beautiful. And it gets that whole Denmark vibe and what is going on at the time across better than I think either of those movies do. Do you agree, Jeremy? No, you've got cats named after these characters.
Yes and no. I think that's a fascinating answer. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead is the first I ever saw of this thing you know from somebody else's perspective. It probably wasn't the first actual iteration of that gimmick, but it was the first one I saw, and it made Hamlet more relatable to me. And when I watch Hamlet straight, I have to work, like, and I'm not saying it's not fulfilling, but because I vividly remember in high school the teacher who got Shakespeare to click for me, and he was the teacher who taught me how to work. You have to work at it. You have to pay attention and understand what the words are saying. And it becomes brilliant. But sometimes I don't feel like working. especially for four straight hours. So, I mean, I love the RNG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, this was written by Tom Stoppard, so it's no rhetorical joke in its own right, but it's certainly not in that verbiage.
No, it's not. Yeah, no.
Yeah. A couple of other answers. Obviously, Observe and Report, I think, is much better than Paul Blart Mall Cop, but the latter got much more money thrown at it and much more eyeballs.
You know what? You are absolutely right that movie's better than Paul Blart Mall Cop. But I'm wondering, according to the rules of the question, because Observe and Report,
is
I think,
glossier?
is the more stylish film.
Oh, I don't know about that.
There are scenes in Observe and Report where they're clearly doing like Taxi Driver type stuff and doing things with the camera. Paul Blart is like a flatly shot American, you know, comedy sitcom.
I guess I was interpreting it. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think I was interpreting it more as just like gloss as opposed to.
Yeah, there's probably more budget to Paul Blart than
that's a good way to state it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the comparison of Boiler Room to Wall Street, I think there's more, you know, financing. I think Boiler Room may be even better quote shot than Wall Street, even though Wall Street does have its indelible images. I know what you mean.
The question would come down in this, you know, like in the inside this question would be Boiler Room versus Glengarry Glen Ross, because like that's another big huge influence. It's not, I mean, Glengarry Glen Ross is not Wall Street stuff, but it's salesman stuff, and they quote that movie in Boiler Room. If it came down to those two movies, what do you think is more stylish? I mean, Boiler Room's probably more stylish than Glengarry Glen Ross, which feels like a play that they've shot with a few more close-ups and angles and things like that. You know, which one would you pick out of that? It would be hard for me. I like both of them. I think I've seen Glengarry way more than I've seen Boiler Room, though.
Yeah, me too. I'll also end by saying Ants is a better movie than Bug's Life.
Oh,
fight me
now!
Fight me
now! You've thrown down the gauntlet.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a better voice cast
about that movie.
It's got more adult humor and not, you know, profane humor or anything like that. But it's, you know, the same thing about a conformist that's not conforming, and Ants delivered the goods for me, mm-hmm. more so than A Bug's Life. Go back to the well on that one. All right. What do you want to end with? You want to end with accent, shouting match, either one of those.
I'll let Jeremy vote.
Okay.
Or we could do both.
Then I'm going to go with shouting match.
All right.
What is your favorite shouting match in a movie?
I came up with three on this one. Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington in Crimson Tide is one of my favorite.
That's such a great shouting match.
It is, especially when he's like, we don't make decisions based on intuitions, ideas, little devils or angels on your shoulders, you know, and stuff like that. And then by the end of it, Denzel's trying to very, very calmly talk about this problem with the message that's been broken. And by the end of it, Gene Hackman's like, he's like, Mr. Hunter, I've made a decision. Yeah, I'm the captain of this boat. Now shut the fuck up. And then the whole boat just goes silent after he says that. The momentum just carries on into the next thing where he's like, you know, when Denzel like tells the captain of the Cobb guy to arrest Ramsey over that, take him to a stateroom, and that's where Denzel starts to really get angry, and he's like, now Cobb, and all that. Martin Sheen and Michael Douglas in The American President.
Oh, nice.
They're playing pool, And Martin Sheen's like, you got to go after this Richard Dreyfuss guy because he's just making all these gains because you're not saying anything back to all the stuff that he's saying and everything. And Michael Douglas says something to the effect of like, why haven't I ever seen you out there, AJ? Why haven't you ever been out there trying to get into office and everything? And Martin Sheen's like, because if I didn't, you'd be the most popular history professor at the University of Wisconsin. basically saying you are where you are because of me. And then Al Pacino and Russell Crowe in The Insider, this is after the program has, I believe it has been edited, and shown, or it's either been edited or the decision from CBS is not to show this. And Russell Crowe is teaching a class in this high school and Lowell Bergman, played by Al Pacino, is telling him they don't want to, he first off tells them they don't want to air it. And then he tells them all these different rumors that are going around about him that Brown and Williamson have basically pumped into the media and started to ruin his character. And Al Pacino's like, did you spar with a judo team in the Olympics or whatever? Did you fight with an Olympic judo team in the Olympics? I don't even know why that's a scandal, but he's like, oh my God, what the fuck is this? He's like, I sparred with the judo team. I sparred with them. And he's like, I'm out there. Al Pacino's like, I'm out there trying to help you out, man. And he's like, I fight for you and I still fight and all that. And Russell Crowe is like, well, you better improve your batting average, and then hangs up the phone. I love that whole thing. And the Insider's so good. It's a movie that even on this podcast, it's underrated. We've mentioned it many times, but it's underrated.
Good stuff.
My recency bias goes right to the Suicide Squad because I love when Idris Elba is getting a visit from his daughter in prison, and there's this moment where for like 25 seconds, they both just go, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And it just stood out to me as so oddly authentic. And then the other one I thought of that I really like is Pulp Fiction, and it's maybe not a shouting match, but just the whole sequence of just get the shot. I will if you let me. That whole sequence is one of the most memorable parts of that whole movie for me.
That's Storm Reid. That's a Wrinkle in Time. It was in that fuck you thing, and it escalates so quickly.
Too. Oh, she's in Euphoria. She's the
She's Rue's
younger sister.
There's it escalates like immediately. They're like, oh, you know what, fuck you.
there's an episode of Black Mirror where a guy fucks a pig. Did you know that? No. There's an episode of Black Mirror where Bryce Dallas Howard is in this world where, like, you know, likes of your, you know, your online persona is like currency in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you see her at the beginning of that, like, desperately trying to increase her likes and everything so that she can do better things in the real world and everything. And she tries so hard that she actually starts losing. She starts getting disliked more often, and then to the point where she can't even get like a cab or something. And then she gets thrown in jail. And at the end of it, she's in jail and there's a guy in another jail cell across from her. I love this ending because it's like for the first time they're actually free. It feels like they're in jail because the guy's like, fuck you, and she's like, fuck you, and it's not, you don't hear the words, it's just silent. So you just see that, you just read their lips, and it's like, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, and that's how the whole episode ends. And that reminded me. Yeah, it's a great episode. That's what reminded me of the Suicide. I love the Suicide Squad one too, though. It's fantastic. I love that shouting match.
It is great. My answers are, even though it's been memed to death, the Marriage Story argument between Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson.
Oh,
is,
yeah.
Oh, I mean, that's as real as shit gets. I don't know what Noah Baumbach did to those poor actors to put them in that state, but Jesus Christ, it's special. Mm-hmm. And then my one of my recent favorites from a few years ago is Knives Out multiple times.
Yeah.
Anytime the family kind of devolves into this shouting match, it's so perfect. And I wonder how this, you know, how Rian Johnson came up with this, just talk over everybody and everything. But when Ransom comes in for the will reading and everything, and everybody starts, he's eat shit, eat shit, eat shit. And everybody starts yelling, and then it goes to something else. And then it comes back and it's Michael Shannon going, "You want some more cookies, you?" And just to Chris Evans's face. And it's the greatest. It's the greatest ever. And then after she is bequeathed, Ana de Armas is bequeathed the estate, all that stuff of them questioning, and then it becomes like this uproar, and they start yelling at her as she's walking out before Ransom drives up. And Johnson switches to that hand cam as she walks out the door. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. That movie is absolutely gorgeous. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you for the questions. And I think we still have plenty more that we can save for the next time.
I thought we were going to make it, man.
Oh, no. Hell no. We had way too much to talk about, you know, but that's what makes us, man. We talk that's a right. lot about things.
that's our mission. Hey, yo, we talk a lot about things.
Here at the Sincast, we talk a lot about stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to get a tattoo.
Yeah, yeah. That's going to do it for this week. Keep going to Sincast presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We're also on CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter, Discord, and SoundCloud. That's going to do it for this week. Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Barrett Sher. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
Somebody posted on our subreddit last night a post called Captain Ron. I'm going to read it to you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm way behind on podcasts, especially the CinemaSins podcast. Today, I listened to episode 279 of the Sincast directly after I finished episode 102 of Quick Question with Soren and Daniel. That's Soren Bowie and Dan O'Brien from Cracked. Somehow, both podcasts feature a story about how one of the hosts watched Captain Ron only because he was trying to get with the girl. This is, if you remember, my story.
That's wild. That's wild.
At least Soren got his first kiss out of it. Now I'm wondering if it's the same girl and she keeps trying to use Captain Ron to seduce men because associates it with the time she kissed Soren Bowie.
Wow. That's insane.
Even though I would have come first, I'm certain I'm older than Soren.
You definitely are. I think we all are.
Yeah. So she wouldn't have shown it to me because she kissed Soren one time successfully by showing Captain Ron. I just think that is a wild coincidence. It's like that time that Dicer and I both talked about Major Payne and how we liked it because Brian, our roommate in college, made us laugh when he laughed watching it. It's just it's too odd. Like, we're in a simulation, I'm quite certain.
Yep. I agree with all the weird coincidences that happen over and over.
In the Matrix. So he was in Married Housing after freshman year. If not,
yo, before. They have Married Housing?
Yes, they do. MTSU has Married Housing.
Really?
Yeah.
Like dorms for married people?
They're more like apartment buildings, and they're, at least where I went to school, they were more on the outskirts. They, like, you could get to them from a city street that wasn't on campus, but you could walk from them to campus, and you could see the campus. It was like a football field away. So,
yeah, I remember a friend of mine named Steve got married when he was in college, and he and his wife I visited him in one of these housings.
Did it feel like going to a retirement home?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Everyone here is dead inside because they're married.
Yeah, they're in college and they're married.
How much swinging you think happened in those things? Mm. I mean, not in the Nazarene. Well, maybe at the Nazarene College.
Especially the Nazarene College.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a bunch of married folks that are young and horny.
I don't know.
But just
I would imagine it is no different than any other place. Like, yeah. how many people at any given time in the world are swinging? Well, yeah. Apply that percentage to college dorms.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So. I should stop.
You should stop. I don't even know.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't even, like, I was shocked to find out people were having sex at all in college. So.
It's the fact that people are still having sex. You remember that song?
Hang on. I thought that was from I Want Your Sex, but that's not from that.
It was in that era. People are still having sex. It's been going on.
Oh, that's the song.
It's been going on for quite a while.
People are still having sex. What was that? Public? It wasn't Public Image LTD. It was, Enigma.
It's not Enigma, I don't think.
I loved Enigma.
Hang on. Oh, I do remember that song. I like that song. Latour.
Latour. Is
the I want to listen to that right now.
they really like knuckled in on the six.
Oh yeah. It's amazing what pops into your head at times.
But did they dove knuckle it, Barrett?
Ooh, dove knuckling. I really want to see that.
I almost want to know where that came from because it almost seemed like predictive text.
It was. I wanted to make two fake sports because, like, bless his heart, bless his heart is kind of condescending. I don't mean it that way. He's really into disc golf, and he's the one that got us all watching that 3-on-3 or not 3-on-3 or the half court, whatever that funky basketball thing was, where they play to a clock and or a score instead of a clock. And so I was just trying to make the joke that Dicer likes obscure sports, and dove knuckling just came out of my mouth. And before I thought about it at all, I wrote it down, and now I've got it in my pocket. I'm going to write that shit into a sin. I'm going to wait for somebody in a movie to mention an obscure sport, and I'm going to do a whole run, and it'll end with dove knuckling.
Just imagine the practicality of dove knuckling.
Yep.
You don't know what it means. I don't even know what it means.
Just drill down. Just take a second to drill down and see what that looks like.
I don't want to.
It must be nice. It must be nice. Oh,
yeah. There is a little bit of that in this MacGruber scene where he's like, I'm going to throw you through the window. I want to get a throat rip in there. I think that's going to be you, small fry. And then he just gets thrown out of the building. But